James, thank you very much for being with us. We want your take on what's going on today.
Well, thank you for having me here again, and it is always a pleasure to be on with you and your audience. And I just wanted to pick up from something that we were talking about last week, and we've been talking about increasingly in recent weeks, which is this disconnect that I've been noting between what's happening in the markets and what's actually happening in the economy. And not to toot my own horn, but even the economics editor of the BBC is getting on this particular point and has made some points in the recent coverage of the Davos meeting, which just wrapped up there in Switzerland last week. And they're noting that even though, for example, the Spanish economy has shrunk 6% over the last few years in this euro crisis, and 0.6% of that just in the last 3 months of 2012 alone, they're now starting to talk about how the eurozone has turned the corner and everything is peachy keen once again. And of course, we've seen the growth forecast for European countries in 2013-2014 having been slashed, but still there's so much optimism now, and that was one of the dominant themes at Davos this year, is that, oh, the euro has recovered and they've turned the corner and now things are looking up from here. And
is it true, though?
Of course it isn't, and yet another indication of that is
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with James Corbett. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett, and we're basically talking about what happened over at Davos, and apparently all the attitude of all the major financiers meeting in Davos, Switzerland here recently was things are going to get better. Oh, certainly the economy is turning around, production is up, and the stock market's up, certainly. But if you look at the production figures, what's happening to production throughout the world, James?
Well, production is going down generally in a lot of countries, and it's still being led basically by China, and it's on the back of the demand for Chinese manufacturing, which has picked up a little at the end of 2012 and looks like it's going to rally a bit in the first half of 2013, which on the back of that, there's going to be likely an increase in commodity prices in the first half of the year. But I don't think that's sustainable. I don't think that trend is going to continue. I think in the second half of the year, we're going to see the downturn, and that's going to make it even sharper and even harder for the people who are basically relying on this commodity boom to try to support the types of economic growth that we've seen in the past, as you say, from the actual productive manufacturing economy. So, for example, right now we see oil and copper and some of the other materials that China is using to fuel its productive boom right now are trending upwards. But again, I think that's going to see a sharp decline in the second half of 2013. And another thing that's propping it up is, of course, the quantitative easing, as we've talked about before, and the latest round, the $45 billion of Treasury securities a month that are being bought by the Federal Reserve. That is also helping to soften the greenback, which of course makes commodity prices more attractive to foreign investors, which makes them again even a hotter buy. But again, this is a lot of trading and things that have no reflection on the average person in the actual economy. And as I was going to say, another indication of this, the UK economy shrunk by 0.3% in the last quarter of 2012. And yet the FTSE 100 is up at a 4.5-year high. So again, markets keep trending upwards and upwards no matter what the economic data is indicating. And it seems like the markets are really only responding to the politicians' statements these days. They're not responding to what's actually happening in the economy.
Well, Chris, my contention is everything is a matter of perception. And if you can convince people that things are good, why they're going to begin buying homes and cars and all of these things, but it's all done on borrowed money. And basically, of course, America is currently living on borrowed money. And basically, well, they're pouring almost well over $1 trillion, certainly, into our economy that doesn't exist. It's all borrowed money, money that the Fed is creating out of nothing. And one day, well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett. We're talking about finances. Our telephone number, of course, if you'd like to call and you have a question for James, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And as I said, James is pointing out that certainly China is still a powerhouse, but apparently they're economy is beginning to pull back some. So did Germany, even powerful Germany, the center of the economy in Europe, is having some difficulty selling their products, exporting their products, certainly here in America. Why are we importing far more than we are exporting? And because we're importing far more from China than they're importing from us. But the biggest problem right now is we're trying to maintain the economy here in the United States by simply the Federal Reserve buying Treasury bills, the Treasury Reserve buying mortgage bonds. We're talking about $85 billion a month, $85 billion a month. That's over $1 trillion a year. Remember, it took from 1787 right up until the year 1980 to accumulate $1 trillion in debt. We're accumulating $1 trillion, the Fed is accumulating $1 trillion of debt every year, and probably a great deal more than that. I think that they jiggle the funds. In fact, we've heard if they use the real statistics, they use the generally accepted accounting techniques that every corporation is required to use, why the American deficit would be close between $7 and $8 trillion a year. Is that correct, James? Have you heard that? And should we be concerned? After all, they're only figures. It's only debt, and we don't have to worry about that, do we? At least not right now.
Well, not until mid-May, anyway, according to the U.S. Congress, which is when they've kicked the can down the road for this latest debt ceiling fiasco. And because they kicked the can down the road, now some of the ratings agencies are giving the U.S. government a pass. For example, Fitch has said they're not going to downgrade the United States AAA rating because they've managed to resolve the crisis for another few months, basically by agreeing to allow the government to spend anything it wants until mid-May, and then the time of reckoning will arrive then instead of now. So because of that deal, Fitch's has agreed to maintain their rating, but Moody's is currently has a negative outlook for their AAA rating, saying that it's on the back of this debt trajectory that the U.S. government is on, and they're looking for a decrease in debt to GDP ratio, which isn't likely to happen anytime soon, because of course all we have seen in the last several presidencies is that ever upward rising debt to GDP ratio, and of course it's just really launching into the stratosphere now under Obama, with no signs of abating anytime soon. And I guess in the near term, a couple of the things that we should be looking for are, for example, this week there's some economic data that's due out that will probably affect the markets. But the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, will be meeting on Tuesday, and an interest rate announcement is likely to occur on Wednesday afternoon, and then an employment report will be out on Friday. So there's some things that will be happening this week that will be affecting the markets. But I think more generally, I think one of the things that we have to be looking at in the bigger overall picture is some of the geopolitical events right now that are seeming to come to a head at the same time that could really destabilize the tenuous world system, economic system as it is right at the moment. And we see this in theater after theater, in place after place around the world, from the French intervention in Mali to recent reports that Israel is now deploying their Iron Dome missile shield against Syria and the possibility of a chemical weapons attack. We also see Kissinger and others warning that a strike on Iran is even more likely now than it was in the past. And we now see North Korea threatening nuclear war not only against the United States and now South Korea, which I don't really believe that it's going to be able to deliver on. But at any rate, it's just another ratcheting up of tensions in an already tense area. So we see around the globe right now a lot of different places where things are really heating up, and any one of them has the potential to be a type of flashpoint, which could have a knock-on effect throughout the world economy, which, as we all know, is now so based on interrelations between different parts of the globe that any disturbance in any part of that could really have a huge effect on the markets as a whole.
Well, basically, my impression is that our industries are not doing too well. But I'd like to know what you think. Certainly, I can't imagine that people are buying. They claim we sold 13 million cars last year. Of course, in 2008, we actually sold 18 million cars, but now 13 million. People are really, they seem to be going back into debt again, just like they were in 2008. What's your impression there? It seems to me most of what's going on is all, once again, built upon debt. Oh, we can just live great. We'll just borrow the money and invest it, and then we'll borrow now, we'll play today, and then we'll pay tomorrow. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that has to be seen as the underlying basis of this mini rise or rally in manufacturing data in the U.S. and in China. I think it's on the back of a lot of this sentiment that has been generated, as we've been noting, by these economic policies of the politicians that, again, aren't really being reflected in the economy as a whole, where unemployment isn't really going down, and there's no indication that there's actual productive economic activity occurring on the back of all this stimulus. And yet we see the markets rising, and yet we see the manufacturing numbers going up, which can only indicate that people are basically, the consumer sentiment is at the point where people are more willing to open up their pocketbooks and even go further into debt in order to finance this, which again is just another indication that basically all we're doing is going from bubble to bubble, blowing bubbles one at a time, and waiting for one to pop before the next one comes along. So if it's not the dot-com bubble, then it's the housing bubble. If it's not the housing bubble, then it's the stock bubble or the bond bubble or whatever the next thing might be. And in fact, there's now talk on the street apparently from bond traders that they're fearing a 1994 moment, as they call it, where back in the end of 1993, you had the 10-year treasury yield was trending upwards. The Fed at the time, Alan Greenspan, etc., they were worried about this trend. And so they started tightening monetary policy, basically raising interest rates. And they did a few interest rate rises in quick succession that led to some pretty disastrous results for the bond market at any rate. And interestingly enough, we see a lot of the same conditions happening right now. And there's always the possibility that the FOMC and the Federal Reserve could decide to raise rates on the back of what's happening in the economy right now, which might have a similar effect and send inflation booming once again. So we'll have to see again what happens in terms of a lot of these decisions. But really, it just goes to reinforce our point that, once again, it's the politicians and the people in the Federal Reserve and the central banks around the world that are calling the shots right now. It's not what's happening on Main Street, and it's not what the employers and the actual people who are producing things in the economy are saying or doing. And people might buy into this, and that might mean that they'll be more willing to buy that new car or actually go and buy a new house. But I'm not sure that that's the wisest decision in this market. And unfortunately, we might see a very quick halt to that if and when these types of changes occur in the economy.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, James, could you explain to our listeners that these things take a long time for people to understand? Explain to them what happens to the bond prices and to the bond market when, of course, interest rates go up and why that happens. Could you explain to them what happens, why that happens? And let me point out that the bond market is many times larger than the stock market. We always hear about the stock market, but this is the bonds, which are the backbone of our economy. People with money invest in bonds because here is security, and because they get a regular income from it, they're not speculating, or at least they think they're not speculating. But what's going to happen if the insurance rate, if the interest rates go up to the people who own bonds, and then what are they going to do?
When interest rates rise, the value of existing bonds fall because the new bonds will come with a higher yield. So basically, when interest rates decrease, the reverse is true. The value of existing bonds rises because the newer bonds issues will have a lower yield. So people will be more incentivized to get into and purchase the new bonds, and the value of the older bonds will therefore be less. So this is the fundamental mechanism. This is the seesaw. So if there was to be an interest rate rise at this point, then all of the treasuries that people are already holding and which people have been increasingly buying into in the last several years because of the economic storm that they've been weathering, of course, people turn to treasuries as basically a kind of the stability in the storm, as it were, the safest place to go, or so that's what it's traditionally been seen as. So we've seen a lot of people getting into the bond markets in recent years, and suddenly if we start to see some interest rate hikes, and there's some indication that that might happen, but we have absolutely no idea, of course. But if it does happen, then all of those bonds that are already being held will be of lower value to the people who are holding them. And that could be a significant thing for a lot of people in fixed income markets and people who are already sort of holding the bag for the government, as it were. So again,
it's not only the people, it's the hedge funds. It's the big insurance companies. It's the people who hold. So they're going to hold your funds for your retirement. And certainly, a lot of the big investors have invested in hedge funds. And a lot of them certainly have invested in bonds, thinking that this was a safe investment to leave it there. But if something should happen literally overnight, well, you could wipe out our hedge funds, which are highly leveraged investment corporations, or you could wipe out some of our pension funds, both government and private, and leave so many of our senior citizens who've been depending upon the money that they're going to get from the pension fund penniless as they begin to see even Social Security beginning to have to, down the line, is going to have to cut back. There's not enough money. Well, James, would you agree or disagree with my analysis?
100% agree. Unfortunately, of course, in these times of destabilization, it's always the people who are on fixed incomes who are on the front lines of this battle, really, because they're the first ones to feel the effects of whatever's happening with the interest rates and the bond markets, etc. And exactly as you indicate, of course, a lot of people who have a pension fund, have their retirement savings invested in some sort of pension fund, are likely to feel the effects of what's happening in the bond market, probably not directly, and they might not understand what's happening, but of course it has huge effects on their retirement savings, and that makes it extremely difficult. It's an extremely difficult time for people to be retiring either now or in the near future, because there is so much uncertainty about what's going to happen, and it really is so much of the economy is at the whim of the Federal Reserve and whoever's in charge and whether they decide to raise or lower rates. That again, it shows that the markets are controlled top to bottom, and people who like to blame the free market for having caused the recent downturn in the economy are, of course, just completely missing the point, because we live in such a completely centrally controlled economy, and that's just becoming more and more and more apparent as the not only the Federal Reserve Chairman, but the governors of many different central banks around the world continue to wield an increasing amount of power over the economies that they're supposedly overseeing. And another indication of that, we have Mark Carney, the former Bank of Canada governor, who's moving over to the Bank of England, speaking at Davos this year, saying there's even more room for stimulus, and that the central banks of the world should try to achieve escape velocity for their economies by injecting even more money into the system. So unfortunately, it looks not only like the status quo is going to be maintained, but perhaps even accelerated, and we're going to see yet more of the same in the coming future, which, I don't think is good news for people who are looking towards retirement.
But basically, aren't some of the countries demanding that their banks, their central banks, and the regular banks keep more in the way of reserves so that they're not going to get into trouble? Well, what's happening as far as the reserve requirements across the spectrum?
Well, there have been some moves on that front. In fact, we see the latest version of the International Banking Accords, which the name is escaping me at the moment. I can't believe that. Well, I'll get back to you on that in a moment. But the latest round of those International Banking Accords have called for greater reserve requirements for banks. But interestingly enough, those particular requirements, although they were due to kick in already, have been postponed so that banks can have more time to try to meet those reserve requirements. So I think there is an urge for that among certain sectors of the economy and among certain politicians who understand the importance of this. But of course, the banking industry itself is very, very wary of such regulations and does not want to have to meet those types types of reserve requirements, because obviously that's what their entire scam is based on to a large extent, their ability to leverage their monies out to infinity. So we see contrary indications on that, but I think that the trend overall is towards rhetoric on reserve requirements rather than action. And again, I'll change my tune on that when I see more action in terms of countries actually instituting stricter reserve requirements.
Well, because the whole theory behind the increase in reserve requirements is that so the banks will be more stable, that they won't be overextended, and they won't get into the problem that they did before. Hold on there. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. We were just talking about the fact that certain central banks now are requiring the banks that need to have a higher reserve requirements. Now, these are all terms they use simply to confuse you. The average individual doesn't understand, but you better understand, because if you don't understand, why are you simply going to be like a ship simply at sea in the middle of a storm without an anchor and just tossed around? But basically, the whole idea of having a higher reserve requirement is so banks can't be just creating money out of nothing and lending out that certainly credit, massive amounts of credit, creating certainly false prosperity. And then, of course, if things tighten down, while those banks are going to face being crushed like they were back in 2008, where the federal government had to come up with some $750 billion to bail out the banks. And certainly, probably we see probably the real figure worldwide was that the Federal Reserve came up with somewhere between $13 and $16 trillion to bail out the banks across the world, and some of the banks are still trying to get out from underneath those massive loans they had to take. Well, if you have a question at all for Mr. Corbett about what's going on, or what do you think is going to happen, or what you should be doing at this time, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But my fear is, of course, we're going to go back into another contraction. We're going to see a progressive loss in the value of our currency because there's massive amounts of money out there. The only good thing is it's not being put into the economy, but certainly the central banks are sitting on trillions of dollars. The corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars, and they're working in concert not to introduce it into the volume of money that's circulating, because if they did, we'd have runaway inflation. So right now, they're just sort of sitting on it. They're keeping it in bonds. But sooner or later, this whole structure, financial structure, is going to get into trouble because there's nothing behind it. Now, we do then hear the possibility of having a third tier. Maybe we'd have a currency would be the euro, the other would be the dollar, and then a gold currency, a gold-backed currency. What are your thoughts on that? Is that just rhetoric and talk? Or is there really some talk about maybe having a gold-backed currency in the world today? Is that talk legitimate at all?
Well, there has been talk for a few years now between some of the countries like Russia and China that are looking for a transition away from the dollar as a reserve currency. There has been a lot of talk along those lines, and as we've talked about on this program before, there have been things like the Woku and other ideas floated around about how to do that. And some people even do talk about some type of gold-backed currency. But in terms of actual moves to implement that on the world stage at this moment, I still think we're quite far away from that. There hasn't been any type of moves towards something that we would recognize as an alternative to the reserve, the dollar as the standard world currency. So I don't know if that's likely any time in the near future, and I'm not sure that would ever happen with the active and willing participation of the United States or many of its allies around the globe. I think the only thing that might be the wild card in this scenario, at least for the foreseeable near future, would be if countries like China and Russia started moving towards implementing that on their own through their own network. And once again, I will draw people's attention to the BRIC summit in Durban that's going to be taking place in March, where, again, they're expected to launch the BRICS Development Bank, which might be that type of third way, something completely different from the IMF world banking structure, which currently underlies the world international finance. So we'll see if that's possible. But at this point, I just don't see that there's a viable alternative to the dollar on the table.
What you're really talking then would be an independent Asian country, and anybody could trade in that if they wanted to, so they have a choice of trading in euros or dollars or this new Asian currency. Is this what you're suggesting?
Yes. Well, not necessarily specifically Asian. Of course, BRICS also includes Brazil and South Africa, so it's quite a wide-ranging. But basically, yes, some sort of alternative for developing countries around the world that would de-hook them from this IMF system, which is, of course, tied completely to the dollar. So, again, it's a question of how they're going to try to capitalize this BRICS Development Bank and whether this has to do with the incredible amount of gold hoarding that China and Russia have been doing in the last few years. But it should be very interesting to see how that plays out anyway. And
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that we've already seen the indications that this is starting to happen on a certain level. We've seen a lot of bilateral moves between countries, including China and Japan and others, who are now trading in local currencies and completely foregoing the dollar, which has been usually the standard go-between and mediator for currency transactions between countries. So we've already seen that happening in a lot of different countries separately, and it's just a question of putting that into some sort of framework to institutionalize it.
And I think basically what we're going to see eventually is the destruction of the dollar. Those who are tied to the dollar are going to be destroyed. Basically, of course, BRICS meeting in Durban, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. We'll be back in a moment. Give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Federal Liberty, and our guest, of course, is James Corbett. And we have several callers on the line, but we do have one line still open. If you'd like to call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'll get to our callers in just a moment. But before we do, James, would you like to tell our listeners how they could subscribe to the International Forecaster, and then, of course, how they can certainly get your material?
Absolutely. Well, if people are interested in the International Forecaster, I suggest they go to theinternationalforecaster.com. That's all one word, theinternationalforecaster.com, where you can find some of my editorials and some of the other things that are published there are available on the website. And if you're interested in subscribing to get the full 40 pages, which comes out once a week, and starting next week, it will be twice a week with a midweek update, that is available, again, at theinternationalforecaster.com. Or you can write for more details, P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. And if you're interested in my own work, I am at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. I invite people to dip into my archives of thousands of hours of media that's available for download there. And if you do enjoy and appreciate that, I ask for people to support the work by either purchasing a subscription to my own newsletter, or you can purchase DVDs of my material.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we have Dave from Illinois. I will be with Dave in just a moment, but I would simply point out somebody had called in wanted to know what BRICS stands for. BRICS is Brazil, R, Russia, I, India, C for China, and S for South Africa. Certainly three of the most dominant second-tier economies in the world behind the United States and Europe. But, of course, China really is the second-largest economy in the world. And basically, if you take Russia, China, and you combine it with Russia and certainly India and South Africa, we know we lived there for a while, is a really vibrant economy. Why, of course, you're really talking about, and Brazil, of course, has been doing quite well in recent years. It's the strongest country in all of South Africa economically, and industrially. Why? Because you're talking about something that tends to dwarf the United States and, in my estimation, and Europe as well. So basically, this is a major bloc, and they're talking about creating their own currency and their own trading, so they'll trade among themselves and suddenly get away from the dollar. And of course, basically, people do not understand. The dollar has been the dominant currency since the end of the Second World War, as America has been the dominant nation. But, ladies and gentlemen, that will soon be simply a remembrance of things past. And if you're tied to the dollar in your investments or certainly in your retirement, why, I start looking for an escape hatch or at least alternatives so that you will have something at this whole house of cards, or I should say when the house of cards comes tumbling down. Let's go to Dave calling from Illinois, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-2295. Dave, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Good evening, gentlemen. I've got a question. This whole dollar being a reserve currency, that's been, I've been thinking about this a long time. I know what will happen if it stops being true. And Mr. Corbett just said he thinks it won't happen for a while. Well, I'm not, definitely not going to doubt his knowledge. But if the world does keep our dollar for their main currency, for a long, long time to come, they do, we'll still be in trouble, won't we? I mean, the only reason we have had depression is because of that reserve currency status. Well, can that keep us above water no matter how much Congress spends and no matter how irresponsible the government is and so forth? Maintaining the reserve currency will not keep us from sinking, will it?
What are your thoughts on that, James?
Well, being the reserve currency brings with it the privilege of being able to basically print as much money, print your debt, print yourself into debt as much as you like and never having to pay the piper, as it were, because, again, there's always demand for dollars if the entire world is trading in dollars. But America is the only country in the world that enjoys that particular privilege and can be so cavalier with the way that they print their money. And, of course, there are ramifications to that, and there's interest servicing on the debt, et cetera, that, again, is becoming more front and center as we move into the $16 trillion of debt range. But obviously, they wouldn't have been able to get anywhere near that range if it weren't for the fact that they were the reserve currency. I agree that it is likely to transition off into something else. I just don't see that happening in the near term, like within the next year or two, until there's some sort of viable alternative on the table. But when that does happen, I think that the effects are going to be profound. And until that happens, there's at least a demand in dollars, which allows them to continue printing, not mathematically forever, but at least a lot longer than they would be able to otherwise.
You say a year? No, that's a blink of an eye.
Right, you're absolutely right. But things should move very quickly. They could move very slowly. Nobody knows. But I will tell you that if we get into a war or into some sort of a conflict, there could be dramatic changes in the structure, economic structure of this country. And if you haven't looked into the background of what would happen if we had an EMP attack, why, look into it. I don't know if it's coming. But there's some people say it's not a matter of if, but when. And that would simply change everything. I'm just speculating. We'll have to wait and see. Okay, anything else, Dave?
Well, I just comment that no matter what happens, whatever happens, I'd say, within 5 years, we're in deep, deep, deep trouble no matter what. I see no way of going beyond 5 years without having major, major problems. You guys agree with that?
I agree. I couldn't see how they can continue doing what they're doing right now for the next 5 years unless some type of game-changing event occurs between now and then.
So, Dave, we're just going to have to wait and see, but I hope you keep listening and get other people there in Illinois listening, okay?
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Larry, who's calling us from Washington State. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295. Give us a call. Our guest, James Corbett, and Larry from Washington State. Larry, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, hi, Dr. Dan. I would like to ask Mr. Corbett how much gold he thinks the United States has, and if it has any, where is it? And if it has any, why won't they allow it to be audited by an independent auditor?
Well, I think the question answers itself. They won't allow it to be audited by an independent auditor precisely because they don't have as much as they say they do. And I don't know the exact figure of what they're claiming right now. I know it's somewhere in the 8,000-ton range that they're claiming they have in reserves. But again, they won't let anyone actually count it, so it's not worth the paper that it's written on, that number is written on. To my own mind, how much do they actually have? I wouldn't even begin to speculate. I'm going to say it's somewhere between 0 and 8,000, but I would imagine it's definitely not towards the higher end of that range. But again, it's completely guesswork at this point, because it has been literally half a century or more since the last time there was an audit at Fort Knox. So,
well, Chris, the one question is, you know, how much of our gold is in the vaults there in New York City, in the basement there where the Federal Reserve keeps the gold, really not only for the United States, but for France and Germany and a number of other countries. They just have this massive big vault there, and they have the gold piled up in piles, and certainly when they one country sells gold, they move it from one pile to another. But the gold of the whole world is right there in New York City. I don't think anybody ever wondered, well, first of all, what would happen if something happened in New York City, as is prophesied in the Bible, at least. I think that's what they're talking about with Babylon, the last Babylon. And, of course, when Babylon falls, the center of all commerce, why the merchants of the world weep. But basically, how much of our gold do you think is sitting there in the subterranean vault in New York City? Do we have any idea? And is that part of the gold from Fort Knox, or is that other gold?
Well, again, the simple answer is we simply don't know. We only have speculation to work on, and until there is some sort of audit, we really can't say with any sort of authority. There is the holdings at the New York Federal Reserve Bank, which they will let people take tours of if they are so inclined, and you can go down and I haven't myself, but I've heard others who have gone down and seen the piles of gold, which, again, it's there's nothing intrinsic about the gold that says it belongs to Germany or it belongs to France or it belongs to the U.S. It's just arbitrarily assigned, and supposedly they keep track of all of this. But there has been a lot of talk in recent years about how they are leasing out the gold to other nations on a, you know, as needed basis. And who knows if they even really understand who it's been leased to and who owns what particular piece at any particular time, which makes things mighty complicated when countries like Germany start demanding their gold back. So we'll have to see again how that unravels.
I think that's so interesting, Larry, because, of course, Germany had requested the return of their gold. Apparently, they have, how many tons they have, but basically, I think it's about 3,000 tons, is that it?
650 is what I recall reading.
Okay, but basically, of course, they want their gold back from France. France has about 300 tons. And then, of course, the rest of this is supposedly held in New York. And they say, well, they'll give it back to them, over the next 7 years. Well, why won't they give it back to them now? Nobody wants to ask that question, and nobody wants to speculate why the Federal Reserve won't give Germany back its gold. The people in Germany want to look after Germany. That's their primary concern. They're not interested in globalism as much as we are. We want to just keep everybody happy and just simply get everybody go along with this idea of a one-world government under the control of this ruling elite that they represent. The elite here in this country want it. They want it very badly. They spent the whole of their lives working for it. But the Germans want to protect Germany. We don't want to protect America. We want to dominate the world. But for some reason, we don't have the gold, or we won't give it to Germany. And I think this is causing a lot of uncertainty throughout the world. At least that's my impression. What are your thoughts on that, James?
Well, there's a lot of interesting things happening with gold recently, and there's the bears are saying that gold prices are going down because they are demonstrably in the last month or so. We've certainly seen in the last few months prices declining, but the question is whether or not there's going to be an upsurge or downsurge, whether it's going to break out on the upside or the downside. And I think there are some interesting indications coming from things like the fact that Spanish Mountain Gold, which is a British Columbia-based gold exploration company that's recently been bragging about having several million ounces in their most recent project, have just appointed Rothschild, the financial advisory group, as their to their board of directors to review their strategic options with the objective of maximizing shareholder value. So once again, I think anyone who understands what's going on behind the scenes understands that when you're appointing Rothschild to your board, etc., it's, I mean, there's some big moves that are afoot in the gold markets. And I think there's, again, we know there's a lot of pressure to try to keep those prices down. And that, to my mind, is the best reason that there is to be holding gold. If they don't want you holding it, I think there must be a reason for that. And there's obviously an incredible upside if and when the wheels fall off of this economic train.
And, of course, the Rothschilds have dominated the world gold markets going back to the early 1800s, of course, during the time of the Napoleonic Wars. And certainly the great story of how the Rothschilds amassed their amazing fortune there at the time of the Battle of Waterloo is certainly classic of how you can deceive people and create the perception so that most people lose and you win. And that was the Rothschilds who won, and that allowed them then to become the dominant gold force in the entire world. And they've dominated the gold markets ever since then. I believe the current prices of gold are totally manipulated. It's illegal, but that doesn't matter, since they own the government and they control the government. It's not necessarily that the government controls the banks. The banks control the government, and those are the six major banks, the Central Bank of America, the Fed. They determine policy, not our elected representatives. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Larry from Washington State, do you have any other questions or comments?
Yeah, it was a nice discussion about the subject. I guess the only thing I would say is that because they will not allow audit, my opinion is it isn't there.
Well, it's the old adage, if there's nothing to conceal, then why are they concealing it? Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think the reason it isn't there is because it's been stolen, been commandeered and taken somewhere else by the people that you call the shadow of the
Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, I think you may very well be right, Larry. It's just all conjecture, but the old adage, if there's nothing to conceal, why conceal it? And they are concealing it. Okay, fine.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Okay, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. James, what would you tell our listeners they should do? Should they be buying gold bullion? Should they be buying gold bars? Should they be buying gold coins? Should they be buying certainly collector's coins? Should they be buying silver? Or certainly silver eagles? What do you tell people to do?
My advice would be to buy what you can first and foremost, rather than overthinking particularly which pieces you want. I think it's just important to get into the market first. But once you're in there and you're starting to get something under your belt, I think it's important to diversify like it is in any other stretch. And we can see this in a lot of different ways. Of course, you want some bullion, but you also want some coins with collector value as well that you can use to diversify what you have in your holdings. And if and when you have your actual physical needs taken care of, I think there is upside to be seen in the stocks as well, because certainly there has been a huge disconnect that's been noted for some time now between the actual price of gold and the performance of the stocks. So I think that there is some upside, and there's going to be an upswing at some point. So there might be some money to be made from that. But again, I certainly don't recommend any particular stocks myself. I don't know if I can do that in good conscience, but there is upside potential there, and I think that people just again need to diversify that portfolio as much as they can and try to get different points, because once again, when, as we saw in the 1930s, when they tried to confiscate the gold, the people who were holding different forms of gold, not just the ones that were minted in the U.S., were the ones that were able to survive that confiscation legally, at any rate. So again, I think that it's definitely to people's advantage to be holding different forms of gold and silver and to try to diversify.
All right, fine. Of course, at that time, well, of course, the price They took the gold away from the people and paid them, I think it was $20 an ounce. And then as soon as the people were foolish enough to turn in the gold, and only about a quarter of them turned in their gold, then, of course, they've raised the price to $35 an ounce. So those people who were honest, hardworking citizens, trusting their government, lost their shirts. And the people, of course, who didn't trust the government, they did very, very well. They immediately made an increase in the value of the gold, almost doubled the value of the gold holdings. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there's a small little clique that runs our government. I call them the Brotherhood of Darkness. They really are. They come from the dark side. Our telephone number, 1-888-244-2295. We'll be back in a moment to wrap it today. Well, James, at this time, as always, while we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the radio program for us.
Well, again, I'd like to get people to keep an eye on the geopolitics that's unfolding right now as it relates to what could potentially be happening in the economy. Again, a lot of wild cards out there on the table and in a lot of different areas of the globe, from Africa to Asia to the Middle East, and every single one of them a tinderbox potentially waiting to be set on fire. So again, these are the types of things that can completely turn the situation on a moment's notice. And as I've said before, we are so globally interconnected with our economy these days, whether we like it or not, that any disruption in any of these supply lines to any of these different parts of the globe can have huge knock-on effects in the world markets that can eventually filter down to wherever you are and whatever it is you're doing. There's no doubt that we're all tied into this system together. And again, that's the best argument that can possibly be made for why we need to start to get ourselves out of the system as much as it's possible to do so. So once again, I think it's important for people to be investing and buying and thinking about how to build up the local community first and foremost, because again, that's what you're going to be dealing with if and when things come to a crashing halt.
Well, are you suggesting that we may very well get back more to a local system and local barter than this international system we're living in today?
At the very least, an alternative system. It doesn't necessarily have to be physically local, although that would be, I think, the best, most likely scenario in the case of a total collapse. But assuming that we have this long, steady decline, I think internet communities will at least make it possible for people to change their idea of what it means to be a community. And it doesn't mean you necessarily physically have to be in the same place, but as long as you're on the same page and in the same mindset, you can still be there to support each other and you can still build up some sense of community. Again, I think physical community is more important at the end of the day, but there's a lot of different ways to think about this, and we should be thinking about alternatives in every sense and ways to get around the system.
Well, I certainly agree with you. I think we're entering a very, very difficult times. Of course, one reason why I do what I do is to try to warn people to get at least those who will listen to begin preparing for what I think are very, very difficult times that lie ahead. And I certainly appreciate your willingness to be out with us here every Monday evening and certainly to get the information out. And I do hope it helps you to maintain your customers. I do hope it's helping the people of the International Forecaster. Are they holding their own pretty well?
They are, of course, and I certainly hope more people will be continuing to look into it. And if there have been subscribers in the past that have stopped their subscriptions, I think this is a good time to at least look into it. So at theinternationalforecaster.com, you can find more information.
God bless, and thanks very much. Our guest, of course, has been James Corbett. Thanks, James. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.